You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, if you have an office job, do you have one of those big, clunky, complicated desk phones? Is it bafflingly difficult to use to where you'd rather just use your cell phone? A technology expert tells us why many of us fear the office phone. First, it's time for our weekly review of news from around Wisconsin. Governor Walker talked to reporters for the first time since his loss in the midterm election. UW-Stevens Point is revising proposed cuts to academic programs, and a lawsuit from a Wisconsin environmental group is trying to block a metal mine in Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Robert Menser is a statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau. Rob, thanks for being here.
Why, thank you.
And Rob, Governor Walker talked to the media yesterday for the first time since his election loss. And here's a listen to what some of the governor had to say about this idea of moving the date of a 2020 presidential primary election so it wouldn't coincide with the state's spring elections, including a Supreme Court race. Here's a listen.
The bottom line is I was in county government. I always thought it was odd that those of us who were in nonpartisan office were on the ballot at the same time as there were partisan elections. It just seems like there's a disconnect to that. I don't know exactly what they're going to propose, if anything, there, but I just know as a local official, that was always something that was odd.
So this is one of the headlines out of what the governor had to say, Rob. Talk about what this change could mean, why it might happen.
Right. So this is all about, I mean, it seems to be motivated by a desire to protect Governor Walker's Supreme Court nominee who will be up for election in 2020. The Democratic Party is going to be having a hugely consequential presidential primary in 2020. And as the law stands now, that primary would fall on the same date that Wisconsin's statewide Supreme Court race would fall. So the logic goes, the Democrats are having a big primary, Republicans will, you know, presumably not be having one. And so that's likely to have drive up Democratic turnout and make it hard for a conservative Supreme Court justice to gain election.
Right, and the way elections work here in Wisconsin, Supreme Court justices are nonpartisan. With an asterisk, people generally know which one's the Democratic and which one's the Republican Supreme Court candidate. So hypothetically, that really could swing a race.
Yeah, no, right. There's evidence of it in the past. It makes a difference for sure. And now it's not like it depends. You know what's going to the case in 2020 might be different. In 2024 and beyond. So it's a slightly odd way to make state laws, but like the impact is real enough and on the Wisconsin Supreme Court. So right now the court has four conservative justices, three liberal justices. There's an election next year for an open seat because the former Chief Justice Shirley Abrahamson is retiring. She's one of the liberal justices. So this could be an opportunity for conservatives to expand their majority on the court, but we are coming off an election where Wisconsin just elected a slate of all Democrats to statewide offices, so Republicans maybe don't like their chances or at the least are worried about their chances in that race. And then that would mean, so if a liberal candidate does win in 2019, that would mean that the 2020 court election would have the potential to tip the balance of the court.
And is there pushback on this idea saying, oh, hey, wait a minute, don't use this lame duck session to tweak the way elections work?
Of course. Democrats are making the case that they are they're making up rules, that this is changing the playing field here in an unfair way for partisan reasons. The Republicans have the power to do this, and we'll see. Even Governor Walker in that clip that you played was not committing that for sure this legislation would advance, but it is something that could happen, whether or not regardless of any sort of political backlash.
And this was the first time that Governor Walker had really talked publicly about his election loss. The way the timing worked out, he didn't do a concession speech on election night because that went really late. He had a written statement that came out the next day, officially conceding the race. How did he talk about the outcome of the election?
So he talked about being the victim of a blue wave, or you know, he attributed his loss to massive turnout among Democrats motivated by opposition to Donald Trump. And I think that that political analysis is fair enough, right? I mean, that's, you know, in the same way that Walker came into office in 2010, which was a red wave, a wave election for Republicans, and that was a great benefit to him and to the legislators who took control that year. This year went the other way, and that's politics. But it is yeah, that's sort of his reading on the thing is this, yeah, it's not me, it wasn't my performance or policies. It's just this is a bunch of turnout.
We're rounding up some of the news of the week from around Wisconsin with Rob Mentzer from the USA Today Network, Wisconsin. Moving on to some other stories out there, a new announcement, Rob, from UW Stevens Point. Earlier in the year, they'd said, hey, we're looking at cutting 13 major programs, mostly in the humanities and social sciences. There's some student protests and backlash. Now they're out with a new plan, still some cuts and revisions. What are we seeing there?
Right. So the university unveiled this somewhat scaled down plan that to cut six majors instead of 13. Six is less. That is fewer majors. They would still cut history, geography, French, German, some other areas, but, and this makes a difference, they would not cut some larger programs, including English, political science, art, sociology. All of those had been on the chopping block in the old plan. So it's being perceived, the reception to this announcement has been undoubtedly more muted on campus and in the community because it is less dramatic than the one that was introduced in the spring. It does reflect some of the same pressures, some of the same philosophies, I guess, as UWSP tries to figure out how to adapt to its own declining enrollment and troubled budget situation. But yeah, I mean, six is a lot fewer than 13, and I guess that makes a difference in how it's being perceived.
Right, that issue of budgets and declining enrollment, it's not just a UW-Stevens Point story. Other campuses around the state are dealing with similar issues. And you mentioned the philosophy issue, the idea of how much are we doing what we consider the traditional well-rounded education concept versus workforce preparedness, training students in useful skills that they'll have in the job market. That's part of the debate here too, right?
That's absolutely is the driver of the debate, and the chancellor at UWSP in Stevens Point, Bernie Patterson, has put his chips down squarely on the side of vocational that's too strong a word, but career oriented training, and folks in the liberal arts naturally see that as a vote of no confidence there. He also makes the case that university may not be able to be all things to all people, so that there's a question there. Does every campus need to offer a French major, or if you want to major in French, you just know that you have to go to whatever place? So I think there are nuances in the argument here, but yeah, I mean, broadly, this is a move by the administrators in Stevens Point to add career-oriented programs, and that comes at a cost of some liberal arts programs.
And I want to finish up by a look at this lawsuit from a Wisconsin environmental group. It's against the EPA and the Army Corps of Engineers, and it's all about this Back 40 mine, a project actually just over the border of Wisconsin in the UP of Michigan. This is near Marinette, a gold and zinc mine proposal. What is this lawsuit all about?
Right. So this is a mine in the UP, and of course it's of high interest in northeastern Wisconsin and even Green Bay because of potential environmental effects in that region and potential economic impacts as well on Wisconsin. And this week, a new lawsuit by a citizens group is they're trying to stop the project, and their argument is that they're suing the EPA and the Army Corps of Engineers on the argument that it's the federal agencies that really should be in charge of permitting the project, and they should not have done what they did, which was say that it's up to Michigan state authorities. And the reason is because it's right on the border, because it's right on a waterway. They say that these impacts, you can't just say this is just a Michigan project.
And this is there's a concern over the Menominee River in particular. Now, as we've talked about before, Rob, lawsuits, they can take a while. Do we have any sense of the timeline with this just being filed this week?
Oh, I don't. These things take a long time. I think this can be understood as a bit of a last-ditch move by these activists, although last-ditch moves have a way of taking a long time in court, too. What triggered it is all the final permits were granted as of June. The project received all of its permits from the state of Michigan to move forward. So this is what's left is to try, for the activists to try to argue that those permits should not be sufficient in themselves.
We'll leave it there for now. Rob, thanks as always for joining us.
All right. Thank you.
Rob Metzer is a statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin. He's with us each week to check in on what's happening around the state. 77% of Americans own some kind of smartphone, according to a survey by Pew Research Center last year. And a report from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, for some reason, shows that the number of Americans with a landline is down to 46%. That figure's dropping each year. So as smartphone use grows and landline use falls, why do we still have huge, complicated desk phones at many workplaces? The Wall Street Journal recently did a story on this and quoted a 40-year-old professor in California saying, quote, "It's giant and has like 5 million buttons. I don't even know how to dial out on it." He eventually unplugged it and stuck it in a drawer until the office manager made him put it back. Does this sound familiar to you? Give us a call at 800-642-1234, if you can, on that phone. Do you have an office desk phone? Do you even know how to use it? Do you just use your smartphone for work? Do you like having a desk phone, or does it get in the way? You can call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. I'm going to have to dial a 9 to get out. Or email ideas@WPR.org. You can also tweet us at @CentralTimeWPR. Rich Costello is a senior communications analyst with the Massachusetts-based International Data Corporation. Rich, welcome to Central Time.
Yeah, hi. Yeah, thanks, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Well, do you have this system of fancy desk phones at IDC there?
They do. And I will just the caveat is that I work remotely. So I work from my home office. I'm lucky to be able to do that. So, but I do frequent the office in Framingham occasionally, and yes, they do have their phones on their desk.
Now, I got to say, I was a holdout on getting rid of my home landline for a long time. I finally did it and made the switch to cells only, and a lot of people are doing that. But it really seems like workplaces, offices are not. They're maybe doubling down. Are we seeing a lot of workplaces still committed to having a landline phone system?
I think so. Yeah, it's going to. I've kind of been covering the this industry, the business telephony industry, if you will, for a number of years. They're very conservative, in my opinion. So it takes a lot to kind of move the needle, if you will. So we do see the users kind of pushing back, no doubt. As that Wall Street Journal article indicated, there's a level of frustration with desktop phones, and we are obviously people are more used to using mobile devices. They're more intuitive, easier for them to use. They're more comfortable with them. But the business has this investment typically in this equipment, sometimes they mandate the use of phones, and again, sometimes users just push back on that all the time. We're hearing more and more of that.
Well, you mentioned user interface, and this seems like a big story. Smartphones, they're really working to make them as intuitive as possible. But a certain Midwestern public radio station just got new phones, and they are baffling. It seems like they're getting more complicated and less intuitive to use. Is that just me, or is this something that's happening?
No, I think that's correct. I mean, they're trying to design more consumer oriented devices, but you know, they have these functions that, you know, they're trying to fit on the phones, and it just I guess it just kind of makes things as complicated as in the past, I think. We do see users who are preferring to use other devices. So what I see, I'll tell you, my scenario here is, in my office, I have multiple devices at my disposal, right? I have a cell phone, mm-hmm. and I have a landline phone, a desktop phone. I also have my PC, which I tell you the truth, I use that a lot to do, like, conference calls where we, you know, obviously we have a voice connection, but we also have the screen where we could share data. So, you know, it really depends. I can switch around. I use the PC a lot. I use my mobile phone on occasion, and then on this landline, which, by the way, I'm on now, my landline, I will use
Sounds
that.
Sounds good.
Yeah, thanks. I will use that for if I'm talking with a client or, where it's an important call and I really don't want to kind of chance it with, any kind of performance issues, I will typically use a landline, and I think that is that's a consideration as well, is that, like, the performance and the quality. I think the desktop stuff does do that. The desktop phones, they do that better than, say, a cell phone. But, again, it comes down a lot of times to personal choice.
Talking to Rich Costello, research communications analyst with the Massachusetts-based International Data Corporation, looking at the office desk phone. They're big, they're often clunky and confusing, and they're sticking around in the age of the cell phone, the smartphone at the workplace. Rich, you've watched companies probably put in new systems. Do they do enough training? Do they show people how to use all the features on these fancy office phones?
Yeah, great question. And that's an important part of it, right? The training. And, a lot of times they will give you kind of a quick once over, if you will, on the phones, which people quickly forget after like a couple hours. Don't even kind of want to be bothered using something like that. And then they also give you like maybe something like some documentation or like kind of a quick glance at, you know, some of the key features, things like that. So, yes, that does happen. But, again, I just, I think it comes down to, like I mentioned, kind of personal choice. Some users just kind of push back on the desktop phone and all the complexity and would rather do it with a device that they're comfortable with.
Now, stepping back a bit, Rich, technology is just changing so fast. Is this a quandary for businesses and other organizations to say, we need something new. This thing we get tomorrow, we might be using for 10 years, or it might be obsolete and unsupported in 6 months. How are we navigating this?
Not very well, I would say. So you're absolutely right. The thing about the desktop phones, it's quite an investment. You know, if you're talking about a business that has hundreds or maybe thousands of users, and you multiply that by the number of desktops and the number of phones required, that's a pretty big ticket, right? A cost item for them. And a lot of times they will make that investment, and obviously they want people to utilize that investment. So that's one consideration as well. You know, IT, like, procures these things. They get them, they install them, they support them, they want people to use them. That's kind of the conundrum, I guess, is you're getting pushback from one side on to leverage these things and, And then the users are saying, I don't want to use this. You know, I'd rather use something else. So it certainly has changed, you know. And then you're talking about some newer users coming in, newer, younger workforces. You know, they think differently about how to use some of these tools. They want more cutting-edge tools, you know, in their kind of their work day and their work processes. And so they're kind of moving away from some of this more traditional types of tools, i.e. the phone. So there's several dynamics happening within the business workforce today.
Do businesses need, and other organizations need, you know, alongside their IT staff, sociologists figuring out, okay, it's not just a matter of installing the wires. We need to change the culture to use this new technology.
Yeah, you know, I think they need to do a better job about it. Yeah, absolutely right. I mean, I think if you're looking for a good project, right, a kind of like a best practice around installing a new system like this, is you really got to kind of get the feedback from your users, right? You know, in the past, what they've done is, you know, bought 1,000 desk phones and rolled them out to everybody, right? And they kind of shotgun the problem. But more and more, you need to kind of break that down. You know, you need to have people talking to other people, talking to the end users. Okay, is this what you want? Are you comfortable with this? Does this help you? And you got to gather all that data and you know, kind of fold that into the formula, so to speak, and maybe not come out with like this blanket 1,000 desktop phone approach to things. But, you know, again, a smarter way to do things, right? If people want to use their mobile phones, okay, there's a segment, maybe 30-35% of the people that just want to use their mobile phones. Okay, we'll work on just kind of locking them down and securing them and make sure everybody's protected. And then we'll roll out desk phones to people that really want to use a desk phone. So again, you're absolutely right. There needs to be, you know, kind of a smarter approach.
Thanks to Rich Costello with International Data Corporation. We talked to them about why in the age of smartphones, the big confusing office desk phone is still widely used today. Lawmakers held a public hearing this week on whether or not to grant paper products company Kimberly-Clark a $70 million incentive package. The company has said one of its Wisconsin plants in Neenah will close, but another plant in Fox Crossing that employs about 400 people could stay open if the incentives are approved. The news comes as another sign of Wisconsin's struggling paper and paper products industry, and our next guest says warning signs should have been heeded a long time ago. Tom Nelson is Outagamie County Executive and a former Democratic state lawmaker. Tom, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Great to be in the program.
Well, before we get into this incentive debate going on today, talk to us some about the history of Kimberly-Clark in Neenah in the Fox Valley area.
Well, Kimberly-Clark was born here, so to speak, in the 1800s. Communities like the Village of Kimberly was one of their namesakes. And, of course, the industry is the paper industry, and it has driven the local economy for decades. And a lot of folks and families here throughout the years have relied on Kimberly-Clark for good-paying, family-supporting jobs. And it's companies like Kimberly-Clark, as well as the rest of the paper industry, that are largely responsible for pulling generations into the middle class. So it has a lot to do with our success in terms of the economy and jobs, but it also goes to culture. We are the Paper Valley. It's not called that for nothing. There is the Kimberly Papermakers right down the way who are now in the football championship. So this has so much to do with who we are, the cultural implications, the economy, social, and so forth. So it's a pretty big deal.
And let's talk about the industry a little more. It's not, people might think paper, they're thinking pulp paper, newspaper, print, packaging. This is also paper consumer products. There's a pretty wide variety of products involved in this industry.
Yeah, that's right. And I think one of the misnomers when it comes to paper industry, you know, folks think that this is a dying industry because they think of paper and they think of electronic substitution. But there's so much more to the paper industry. And Kimberly-Clark really is a perfect example of that. Much, if not most, of the products they do have nothing to do with electronic substitution. They are consumer products like light Depends and diapers and things like that. And overall, not just Kimberly-Clark, but other mills and paper companies here in the Fox Valley, like Expira Specialty Solutions, which is one of the largest, I'm sorry, the largest specialty paper maker in North America. You have Appleton Coated, and I'd like to talk about that in a few minutes, which is a local homegrown company, a paper mill, that is making the transition to brown paper grades. And that's important because that is one sector of the paper industry that is growing and is thriving. And it's also part of the industry that I believe that we're seeing right now that can grow and thrive hand in hand with new in industries and businesses like Amazon. If you think of Amazon, much of what Amazon is a brown paper box on your front stoop. And it's paper makers like Appleton Coated right here in Northeast Wisconsin that are responsible for making the raw product that is used for the boxes and so forth. So the paper industry here is alive and well. The challenges that they have, I think, really come down to changes in consumer tastes and market trends. And as long as we stay ahead of the curve, paper will continue to be a very important and a growing industry here in Northeast Wisconsin, around the state and the country.
Talking to Outagamie County Executive Tom Nelson about Kimberly Clark, the company, the paper industry, and paper products industry more generally in northeastern Wisconsin. Now, Tom, this Kimberly Clark plant closing story has come out. You know, over the last year, it's been a hot topic in the state legislature. I understand you've been saying there were warning signs.
That's right.
Have been on this issue earlier. How so?
That's right. You cannot dispute the fact that there was a clear trend that really goes back about a year ago. In September of 2017, Appleton Coated went into receivership. About 2 months later, Appian, which is formerly Appleton Papers, went into bankruptcy. And about that time, a smaller converting operation called U.S. Paper Converters was going out of business, and they shut their doors December 31st of last year. A month after that, you had the news about how Kimberly Clark was going to, quote-unquote, downsize to the tune of 5,500 jobs, not just here in America, but across the globe, because it's a global company. And the first two plants that they announced were right here in their hometown, the nonwovens facility in downtown Neenah and the Cold Spring facility in Fox Crossing. What was surprising about that is those were the first two plants that were announced right off the bat, and they're right here in Wisconsin, and they're right here in the hometown. In addition to that, Cold Spring is a state-of-the-art facility that is extremely profitable. Talking to folks at the plant, both workers and managers, the number that I hear again and again is that plant, that operation, clears almost $1 million every single day.
Yeah, sometimes you hear when there's a factory closing, and I'm thinking of, for example, the Oscar Mayer closing in Madison, that it's an older facility. We want to go to more modern facilities. Retrofitting it would be more expensive than starting new somewhere else. You're saying that wasn't the case
in that plant. It wasn't the case at all. And I think what happened with those, you know, especially the Appleton Coated, the one that went in receivership, they were sold, and when you go into receivership, it's not like bankruptcy because the whole place shuts down. The workers are locked out. It's a very draconian version of bankruptcy. And what we did there is we took court action to compel the new owner to find a new owner that would run it like a mill. That owner, which still owns now Midwest Paper Group, found that that facility could generate revenue and be extremely profitable. And what they had to do to become profitable is they had to switch from white grades to brown grades. And see, that is the secret. And I think that is the appropriate role that the state can and should take. And that is to incentivize and to support paper companies that are trying to stay ahead of market trends, consumer tastes, by retrofitting and by transitioning to more profitable grades. That is the secret of what we need to do to make sure that paper remains a strong and vibrant industry now and for years to come. As far as Kimberly Clark, that is a head-scratcher. It is a profitable operation. They've sunk a lot of money into that, and so people just can't, no one really knows, and no one can really answer definitively why Kimberly Clark is in the spot that they are right now.
Let's take that to today. Now, we just had this hearing in the State Budget Committee on the idea of these subsidies. It's still up in the air. The Assembly passed to the Senate. Big question mark there. What is your take? Do you think the state should give these subsidies to Kimberly-Clark to try to keep one of these two plants open?
I think that there's a third way. I think that there's a third-way solution. This issue, and specifically what has happened in the state Senate, has been out there now for 8 or 9 months. The Assembly passed, I believe, sometime in February, then it went to the state Senate, and the state Senate has not taken action on it. So here we are 9 months later. I think a lot of people look at this issue, look at this specific bill. The fact that they have not been able to pass this in 9 months tells you, and knowing that nothing has changed, people are not optimistic, right now at least, about this bill passing. I think that there's a third way. I believe that you can craft a solution that includes not just money to entice and keep Kimberly-Clark here, but also to carve out some of those funds to establish what I've called and what other people are supporting, the Papermaker Fund. And so that's a dedicated fund that could help companies like Appleton Coated that could use the resources, that could use the capital to make the transition to brown grades, to help out Aptheon, to help out U.S. Paper Converters. This is most likely not, this issue is not going to end with Kimberly-Clark. There's going to continue to be challenges, and I think if we just work on a bill that only addresses one of those companies, Kimberly-Clark, we are simply going to be back where we started trying to fix another problem. Now, I should say that I've been very heartened by what Governor-elect Tony Evers has been saying about the industry, and that is what, you know, and that we need an industry-wide solution. We don't need another Foxconn. We have to support Wisconsin businesses, homegrown businesses that have supported communities, that have built up the middle class for decades now. And that's how we have to attack the issue and the challenge with the paper industry right now.
Talking to Outagamie County Executive Tom Nelson about Wisconsin's struggling paper products industry, in some cases not so struggling, he says, as lawmakers debate an incentive package aimed at keeping a Kimberly-Clark plant open in the Fox Cities area. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you or someone you know work at one of these Kimberly-Clark plants in Neenah or Fox Crossing or in the paper industry in the Fox Valley in general? Or do you work or live in the area? What does it mean if these plants in particular close? How do you see the role of the paper and paper products industry fitting in to that part of the state? Or if you've seen the paper industry grow go away where you are, the local paper mill shut down in your part of the state, love to hear from you about how that's impacted your community. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. We continue our conversation with Outagamie County Executive Tom Nelson talking about Kimberly-Clark, possible subsidies, and where the paper and paper products industry fits in northeastern Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, questions, and experiences. That's 800-642-1234. To your calls now, Dennis is with us in Two Rivers. Dennis, hi.
Hi. I know there's been quite a bit of controversy in comparison of Foxconn and Kimberly-Clark. And I know the paper industry has been hard on the environment, but with Foxconn, what I understand is they're changing laws and they're saying, well, we're going to change wetlands and going to build wetlands here, which isn't necessarily going to work out well either. So as far as if the Kimberly-Clark plant stays, is it going to be changed or is it going to be the same as before?
Well, that's a good question. I should just kind of clarify. So the Cold Spring facility is a paper converting operation. So they're not making a commodity. They're not actually making the paper. They're taking the raw material and creating a product. In this case, that depends on undergarments. So that's what's happening at Cold Spring. The idea is if they get this money, about $70 million over 15 years, that it would stay open and that there's a possibility that they would continue to invest in the facility. I think a number of company officials has said it could be as much as $500 million. But outside of that, I haven't heard many more specifics.
And on the environmental side of things, Tom, how does that is that an ongoing concern with the paper industry, the paper product industry in your part of the state?
Well, I think it was a concern up until about 10, 20 years ago. This is an industry that has really evolved into a clean industry that has many environmental safeguards and practices, much different than maybe it was like 50 or 60 years ago. We had the issue with the PCB cleanup, and that goes back about 20, 25 years ago. Much of that cleanup, most of that cleanup has already been taken care of. So to answer Dennis's question, no, the answer is no, that this is not a concern.
Thanks for the call. We'll go now to Andrew in Green Bay. Andrew, hello.
Hey, how are you guys doing?
Good. What do you want to tell us about?
Good. So I'm a beginning farmer up in Green Bay, and one of the things that I'm really excited about is the new hemp bill that went in, and I've been trying to think about ways that we can utilize hemp in Wisconsin, and I think paper is one of those things that we could absolutely take and convert some of the byproducts into, and especially this Cold Springs facility that you're talking about where it's taking raw material and turning it into a potential paper product. Why not put hemp in there?
Andrew, thanks. Is there room for hemp in the northeastern Wisconsin paper industry?
Quite possibly, and I really appreciate Andrew's comment and question. That's exactly what I'm trying to get at. We need to think creative. We need to stay ahead of these market trends. And we also need to think about, okay, what are different processes and what can we do? I mean, what is the future of paper? And I think thinking creatively about how we can marry these industries, whether it's a hemp and paper or any number of combinations. So that's what we need out there. We need people like Andrew who are asking questions like that, who are thinking creatively. And then the state's role is to take some of these ideas, folks in industry, folks in labor who are coming to the table saying, look, you know, this is what we can do. This is the future. And then support that. I think that is the right and proper role of the state. And that's kind of like what we did with Appleton Coated last year, although it's quite different because we didn't get any state support. But the folks at Appleton Coated, with Doug Osterberg and Denny Lauer from the USW and John Geenan and Mike Bolton, they said, look, you know, this can be these three paper machines. If we get some support, if we get some capital, we can convert this to a brown paper operation. They did that, and the orders have been coming in hand over fist. They're making money. They retained about 300 jobs. The sky is the limit. So I think what Andrew's talking about, his proposal, I can't speak specifically to how hemp might figure into the paper industry, but he's definitely on the right track. So thank you, Andrew, for that question. Appreciate it.
And Tom, just in our last minute or so, is there a UW role? When you think about the discovery of ways to measure butterfat up to biotech, is there a similar role for UW-Green Bay or UW-Oshkosh in researching these future trends you've been talking about?
Exactly. Another great comment and really good idea. One of the things I was talking about, we were talking about a year ago, we lost about 30 years ago, we lost the Institute of Paper Chemistry right down the river here in Appleton to Georgia Tech. And that loss, I think, stung back then, and I think we are still feeling the repercussions because that's where the innovation goes. If we want the paper industry to thrive, if we want to be strong, not just now, but 10 years or 20 years down the road, we need to have a center of research, development, and education. The Institute for Paper Chemistry did that here in the Fox Valley, in the Paper Valley, up until about 25 or 30 years ago. Stevens Point has got a great program. We need to support those programs there. We need to engage the good folks at Lawrence University, at UW-Fox, at UW-GB, and we need to connect them to industry. Once we do that, we can help secure the future of paper. So thank you for that. Appreciate it.
Tom, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Good to be on.
That's Tom Nelson, Outagamie County Executive, former Democratic state lawmaker, with us to talk about Kimberly Clark's history in Wisconsin as lawmakers consider a $70 million incentive package to keep one of its Fox Cities plants open. Today is the release of the Coen Brothers' newest film, The Ballad of Buster Scruggs. It'll be available on Netflix and in select theaters across the country. Adam Naiman is a film critic and contributor to The Ringer pop culture website. He's also the author of The Coen Brothers, This book really ties the films together. He reviewed their new film for Wisconsin Public Radio.
Joel and Ethan Coen's new film, or their new anthology, is called The Ballad of Buster Scruggs. And originally, people heard about it and thought that it was going to be like a miniseries with six long episodes. But in fact, they're each about 20 minutes long. It runs a little over 2 hours. And each of them are stories that are sort of set in the American West. And they're almost like foundational myths or primal scenes that account for where American life is now. I mean, that's how I read it.
People are so easily distracted. So I'm the distractor with a little story.
People can't get enough of them.
Because, well, they connect the stories to themselves, I suppose.
You know, you have a character like Buster Scruggs in the first episode, who's this singing Roy Rogers cowboy played by Tim Blake Nelson, who's quite charming until he becomes frightening. And he's this weird contradiction of someone who on the one hand represents the fun of the Old West and on the other represents kind of its violence.
Buster Scruggs. I got other handles, nicknames, appellations, and cognomens. But this one here, I don't consider to be even halfway earned. Misanthrope? I don't hate my fellow man, even when he's tiresome and surly and tries to cheat at poker. I figure that's just the human material.
There's an episode featuring Liam Neeson as the proprietor of a traveling show that I would not dream of spoiling, but which, as it plays out, really seems to be about waning values of art and culture within a commercial marketplace. They have an episode set on a wagon train on the Oregon Trail, which is, of course, all about manifest destiny and about trying to found the country.
Okay. There's a pocket up there. How far, we don't know. You're up there. Okay, Mr. Pocket. I'm a comer.
And I think what unites these episodes, because they don't connect as a story, they're all independent of each other, is this theme, I think, about mortality and frailty and death, which sounds heavy. And I should say that aspects of this film are quite funny and aspects of this film are quite charming.
People are not the same. There are two kinds, utterly distinct.
And what would those be, madam?
Upright and sinning.
I challenge your credentials, madam, for assessing human worth. People are like ferrets.
But as the Coens have gotten older, they've started dealing with death more directly. And I think that in the guise of making a popular, accessible Netflix show, they've done something quite severe and quite serious. And I think its best moments are up there with the best stuff that they've ever done. So I think that it's something that's definitely worth seeing.
Well, we'll just have to see, won't we?
I had a dream last night.
What was that about ferrets? Adam Neiman is the author of The Coen Brothers. This book really ties the films together. You can catch a full interview with Adam about the entire Coen Brothers film catalog on WPR's Beta. It'll air Saturday, December 1st at 11 a.m. Coming up Monday on Central Time, reduce, reuse, reimagine. Our guest says we need to rethink our approach to recycling, starting with the ways we make and buy stuff in the first place. The author of the new book, Vegan Strong, tells us how a vegan diet can fuel an active lifestyle and helps resolve issues around the holiday meal. And we'll meet the newest inductees into the Toy Hall of Fame. You can call in with your favorite toys and the memories they bring back for you. That and more coming up Monday right here on Central Time.